Welcome to Dialogue Out Loud, where we explore the intersections of Mormonism, current events, and scholarly thought. I'm your host, Margaret Olson Hemming, the co-editor of Dialogue, a Journal of Mormon Thought. We are speaking today with Spencer Greenhall, who is an associate professor at the University of Kentucky's School of Information Science, where he studies online social spaces, including those related to Mormonism. As a member and a minister in Community of Christ, he is also interested in restoration theology, especially as it relates to the Book of Mormon or technology. And he's speaking today about his article, Jacob's Temple Sermon as Reinterpretation of Scripture and Rethinking of Sexual Ethics. And I'm excited to talk about this today. Welcome, Spencer.
Thank you so much. It's a real honor to be here.
So your article is up on our website for readers to read for free. It's also available to listen to, or you can read it on paper for those who subscribe. But for those who have not read it yet, can you give us a little bit of a summary of your argument and what you describe in the paper?
Sure. So my argument is building on the argument of others, so I'll give a little bit of context first. So in the Book of Mormon, there's a famous sermon given at the Nephite Temple. It's in Jacob chapter 2. And this sermon has often been invoked to defend traditional religious teachings about sexuality. There's a line in there about God delighting in the chastity of women. And that particular idea and the broader sermon have often been used to say, chastity, it's great. Let's you know, adopt this as part of our sexual ethics. But there have also been many people over time who have noticed that what Jacob is talking about suggests something that is deeper than just a straightforward rule about sexual ethics. There are actually some underlying values that seem to drive what Jacob is talking about. And more often than not, those values are associated with feminism, right? So instead of putting the focus on chastity of women, the focus is on the women in there, right? How are women being mistreated in this context, and how is that driving what Jacob is talking about? So I'm really building on those arguments and just trying to add one little piece to that. And what I'm trying to add is the idea that Jacob is also reinterpreting scripture. He is reevaluating sexual ethics for his context. And so not only is this an act of appealing to deeper values, but it's also a change in a way that's not quite obvious from the text, but we can pick up on if we really dig into what Jacob is saying. And focusing on that change and Jacob's willingness to change the religious teachings of his people as it applies to sexual ethics is a really important lesson, or at least I think so.
Great. Tell me more about this idea of reinterpreting scripture. What scripture is he using and how is he reinterpreting it?
So the most obvious scripture that Jacob is appealing to is he brings out the examples of David and Solomon. And he says, you know, these Nephite men seem to be appealing to the examples of David and Solomon in the Bible. These are men who seemed to be righteous, had lots of wives. And Jacob comes out and he says, well, actually, God thinks that it's a terrible idea. God was really disappointed with David and Solomon. And so you Nephite men should not be appealing to that. The tricky thing about that, though, is that the Bible doesn't seem to suggest that, right? And there are other passages in the Bible that are a little bit more straightforward in allowing men to have multiple wives. And so it's kind of funny. David and Solomon aren't the best examples that the Nephite men could be appealing to. There are other examples that they could be straightforwardly appealing to say, God's okay with polygamy. This is just fine. I don't see what the big deal is. And so Jacob's insistence that God does not appreciate what David and Solomon are doing is not something that seems to be in the Bible. It seems to be coming from additional revelation or his reinterpretation of scripture through what God is telling him in that moment.
Okay, great. Okay, so what first led you to see Jacob's temple sermon as an exercise in reinterpretation rather than as a condemnation of polygamy? How did you get here?
I think there are two books that really opened my eyes to this reading. The first is Wilda Gaffney's excellent book, Womanist Midrash, which invites us to take a look at the Hebrew Bible, what we traditionally call the Old Testament, and to put an emphasis on women's experiences during, you know, the particular portions of the Hebrew Bible that she's really concentrating on. And she is the one who opened my eyes to the idea that at, you know, in this part of the Hebrew Bible, polygamy seems to be, you know, maybe normative isn't the right word, but it's on the table, and there's nothing condemning it within the Hebrew Bible. And so it seems to be just fine. And that stands in tension, right, with what Jacob is talking about. So that clued me in a little bit. But also the Grant Hardy's excellent Maxwell Institute study edition of the Book of Mormon, when I was reading that back in 2020, and the way that the text is formatted, and just reading it reading the Book of Mormon text in a different format, in a different way, was a real powerful invitation for me to approach scriptures that I was familiar with through new eyes. And so a combination of those two books really invited me to look for things in the text that I hadn't seen before. And between the two of those, I started to think, you know, maybe there's something going on with Jacob that I hadn't noticed before. And in particular, I started to get clued into the idea that, you know, what Jacob is standing here stands in tension with other scripture. He must be engaging in some kind of reinterpretation.
That's interesting that it sounds like it was a very embodied experience for you, that the process of reading scripture in a different format, different materiality, led you to think differently about the scripture.
Yeah, I think that's very much true. Just having the same words, it sounds silly to say it this way, but the same words arranged differently on a page was just an invitation, very literally, to see the text differently. Mm-hmm. And the way that Hardy formats the text in the Maxwell Institute study edition, and has headers and strips away some of the footnotes that I'm used to, just was, again, very literally an invitation to see the text in a new way. And I very much appreciated that experience that I had.
So You've talked a little bit about this idea of reading the Hebrew Bible with, like, sort of centered on women, and you do this in your essay. You return to the experiences of women again and again with their sorrow, their broken hearts, the loss of confidence, and that this is sort of the moral center of Jacob's sermon. Why do you think in restoration theology we have sort of overlooked that aspect of this text? Not everyone, as you said, there are people who have written about this topic, but why, especially when there are so few women in the Book of Mormon, we have these women and yet we don't really center them when we're talking about this book?
You mentioned that there are famously or infamously very few women in the Book of Mormon, and I think Book of Mormon readers tend to read the text just as it is presented. I want to use the word superficial here, and I don't mean that as an insult. It's certainly the way that I've read the text in the past. It's there. I'm reading what's on the page, and it's just how it is. And I think it's possible, especially, you know, for someone like me, a white dude, to just read the text and not think any more about that, because it's just what's on the paper. To read women into the Book of Mormon, to read women into the Hebrew Bible, especially for someone from, you know, who shares my privileged perspective, that takes a little bit of extra work. It takes more digging, and I think it takes a different relationship with scripture, a willingness to read between lines or even push back against what's in the text to bring values to the text and compare the text to those values. And that's something that has to be learned. And I don't think it's everyone's first instinct with scripture, especially not for those in restoration traditions, where I think we have a tendency just to read what's on the page and assume that it's as straightforward as it is right there.
I think you're absolutely right. And it's hard for us as readers, for whatever reason, to sort of, as we're imagining the text in our heads, to imagine the people who are there but are unnamed. And of course, women are in the Book of Mormon. I mean, it's a whole civilization. But it's like something, there's like a little bit of a hiccup for us. If they don't have a name, then in our sort of visualization of the text, they're just not present.
Absolutely. You know, I was at a family reunion a couple of weeks ago from when we're recording this, and one of my siblings made a comment about the NBA, and my sister kind of elbowed him and said, "Now, the NBA?" And he's like, oh, I meant the Men's National Basketball Association. And apparently, you know, this is a running joke between two of my siblings that I wasn't aware of before, but noticing that the men's basketball is the default, and it's women's basketball that has to be designated the WNBA. And I thought that was just a wonderful example of shifting our perspectives and shifting our default assumptions about things. So yes, it takes a little bit of a shift of what we're doing. But once we realize there is a shift to be made, it does look a little bit silly. The assumptions that we bring to the text or to a broader cultural phenomenon without thinking too carefully about it.
Yeah, absolutely. And you, in your article, you draw from feminist theologians like Margaret Farley and Marcella Alfos Reed and Lisa Cahill, alongside Book of Mormon scholarship, which I'm always so appreciative when people who are studying the Book of Mormon do these sort of pulling from people who are outside of restoration theology or outside of, you know, the LDS Church or the Church of Christ, because I think it you know, there's so much richness there to pull in, like you have with biblical scholars, feminist scholars. So what did these feminists, what did feminist ethics, how did it help you see, what did it help you see in Jacob that you don't think traditional readings have appreciated?
Well, thank you. First, I want to give credit where credit is due. The original draft of this article did not bring in those voices. And one of the reviewers of this article pointed out that this was, you know, for all my feminist aspirations in this article, I had misstepped here. I was not bringing in other voices. And I just want to say that the experience I had with people reviewing this article before it eventually got published was a wonderful experience. The reviewers had a lot of wonderful comments to make that really improved the article, and this was one of them.
That's great. That's how it's supposed to work.
That's exactly how it's supposed to work. And, you know, in my day job, it doesn't always work like that. But this was one of the best review experiences that I have ever had. And there are parts of it that are so much stronger for that. So if those anonymous reviewers are listening, thank you. But to go back to your question, it was helpful to see a few different things. First of all, to see how what I said Jacob was doing was something that actual feminist ethicists are also doing, deliberately bringing values into conversation with scripture. And I actually come away with the conclusion that Jacob's making a great step here. He doesn't have the most elaborate theory of sexual ethics, and he could maybe be a little bit more feminist in what he is doing. So being able to compare what he is doing with what contemporary feminist ethicists are doing, and especially those who are speaking about sexual ethics and speaking about scripture. So One example, I suggest that Jacob's main value that he is bringing to this is a minimization of harm. And it was very interesting after those readers, after those reviewers stepped in and said, you know, you should really bring this into conversation with feminist ethicists and what they are doing, to read Margaret Farley in particular, and to notice that she starts right with the minimization of harm, but she also says that's a great first step. It's not quite enough. That was helpful for me in some ways validating my reading of Jacob and saying, if Jacob is really emphasizing minimizing harm, that's a great first step. But to also say, Jacob is just a first step. If he invites us to bring our interpretation of scripture into conversation with one particular ethical value, he also does not do the work that we need to do as readers of the Book of Mormon to tease out other values that we are bringing in. So I think that was very helpful to in framing Jacob as an example of something good, but really just a first step towards a broader conversation that Book of Mormon readers need to have to make the most of the example he's setting for us.
Yeah, excellent. I love to hear that. I think one of the things that may be sort of most surprising or disturbing is probably the wrong word, but a little bit shocking to readers is that you speculate that Jacob may be pushing back against aspects of Nephi's legacy, particularly regarding polygamy. And That's a very provocative reading. I think we tend to think of Nephi and Jacob as sort of in lockstep. So what do you hope readers will gain from taking that possibility seriously, even if they disagree? And tell me more about this idea or this argument.
Sure. So I'll start with the second part of that. What exactly am I doing here? I do suggest that Jacob is maybe breaking not only with scriptural precedent, but also with prophetic tradition. And that is a reading I kind of stumbled into. I didn't sit down to write this article and intend to make that argument. But I do end up suggesting that maybe Nephi was somewhat sympathetic to the idea of polygamy, and that Jacob is frustrated with that, and he is needing to push back against that. Maybe he sees his brother as having created this problem that he has. He's chastising the Nephite men. He's saying, look, my father Lehi was always against polygamy. Why are you on board with this idea? And I suggest maybe Nephi has something to do with that. That's a speculative reading, right? We can't know for sure. But I mentioned Grant Hardy earlier. He makes two observations about Nephi in one of his books that I think create the room to understand things this way. The first of those is that Nephi may not have had sons. There's a little bit of ambiguity about his successor as king. It doesn't seem to be one of Nephi's own children. And it could be that Nephi, you know, did not love that idea, would have loved to have a son, could not imagine anyone but a son being his successor as king. And the second thing is Grant Hardy notes that Nephi is not very straightforward when it comes to discussing tensions between Nephi and his father Lehi. So, for example, Lehi doesn't seem to have anything to say to Nephi after the slaying of Laban. If, right, God is two thumbs up for Laban slaying, then maybe Lehi would have been there to pat him on the back and say that this was absolutely what you should have done. No conversation like that. Also, when Lehi is about to die, he has a conversation with many of his children. He does not have a conversation with Nephi, or at least there's not one that's recorded. And this creates a possibility that Nephi and Lehi didn't always see eye to eye, and that Nephi kind of leaves those parts out of his narrative to sort of save face. So, taking those two elements together, I suggest that it's possible that Nephi is a sort of more benign Henry VIII figure, someone who thought that an additional wife could have been the solution to having a son and having a clear heir as king, and that maybe he brought up to his dad the possibility, look, It's here in the scriptures. Why can't I just take on another wife, someone who might produce me a son? And maybe that is where Lehi's prohibition against polygamy came from, is reacting to his son's idea. He goes to the Lord and he says, no, this is a terrible idea. Please don't do it. Another thing that we can point out here is that Nephi never mentions the prohibition against polygamy. When Jacob brings it up and Jacob says, look, there's a history here, that's a surprise to the reader because Nephi never puts those words in his dad's mouth. So that's speculative. We can't know one way or the other, but I think it's an interesting idea to bring up here because, you know, especially in the broader restoration tradition, there's a close relationship between what we consider scripture and the words that come out of a prophetic figure's mouth. So at the same time that we're talking about reinterpreting scripture, it's worth asking ourselves, what does it mean to reinterpret a prophetic legacy? What does it mean to change teachings when those teachings come from maybe a recent prophetic figure? So whether or not this actually happened, I don't think there will ever be an answer to that. But so long as we're talking about reinterpreting scripture, so long as we're talking about bringing values into conversation with previous teachings, I think we ought to expand that to Nephi. I think we ought to expand that to any prophetic figure who has been influential, who has brought forth teachings that maybe it's time to reconsider.
Yeah, it's so interesting, especially given that sort of a, I don't know, superficial, like an easy reading of Nephi is that he's a very boring character.
Yes.
But yeah, if you start sort of looking at these passages that don't quite, they leave some loose ends and you start, you know, kind of wondering, well, what about this? He turns into a very complicated person.
Yeah, and someone who's very concerned, as we all are, with presenting himself in the best way. And again, I mean, that doesn't make him a bad person. It just makes him like everybody else. And if it makes him like everybody else, then evaluating ourselves is something that we can do in response to evaluating Nephi with a more critical eye.
Yeah. Okay, let's move into the section of your essay that has implications for LGBTQ relationships, and also for marriage, monogamy, and the way churches or religious communities develop sexual ethics more generally. Talk about these implications. What does your argument lead you to understand about these issues?
So if Jacob is rethinking a sexual teaching that seems to be in force for his time, and again, that is the Hebrew Bible seems to make polygamy a-okay, and Jacob is coming in on the heels of his father and saying, actually, no, forget what you have learned previously. Forget what the Hebrew Bible says. This is the standard for our time, our place, and our context. That invites us as readers to do the same thing. To not take things for granted, but to bring teachings into conversation with the context that we are in and the values that we ascribe to. And I want to be clear in the article, I don't call for specific changes necessarily. Yeah. In any particular institution or in the heart of any individual person, but I do try and lay out three potential paths where a reconsideration of established sexual ethics could take us. One of those is the importance of legal marriage. Another is LGBTQ relationships. And then another, and this is maybe the trickiest because, you know, it requires distinguishing between the surface level message of what Jacob is saying and a deeper level message, is the importance of monogamy itself. So these are, depending on the denomination, depending on the person, these are all established standards of sexual ethics that people see as being supported by the Book of Mormon, or at least supported by the Bible, or at least supported by religious tradition and prophetic precedent. But if Jacob is really overturning precedent in his time, that invites us to consider these precedents that we might have in our individual lives or in our denominational practice, to poke at them a little bit, to ask ourselves what the deeper values are, and then consider whether God is asking us in a particular moment to change the way we think about things.
It's really interesting to think about, like, I really appreciated that you talk about this in terms of values and time and culture and sort of social context rather than particular reforms. And I think, you know, you don't get into stuff with Joseph Smith, but that's always hanging over this conversation as well, right? And I have been in multiple gospel doctrine classes where we talk about Jacob and bring up this railing against polygamy, and people kind of, you know, laugh a little bit nervously. And maybe the teacher says, like, yeah, I wonder what Joseph Smith thought when he translated this section. Like, and then they, you know, kind of hurry along to another part of the lesson because nobody knows what to do with that, right? And of course, we can't get in Joseph Smith's head, but what you're saying is, as I understand you, maybe Joseph Smith's choices are not in direct conflict with what Jacob is saying. Just this idea that that perhaps this is less about an eternal or of fixed policy and more about values that may be interpreted differently at different periods of time.
Yeah, that's a good question. And like you said, we can't necessarily get into Joseph Smith's head, ask ourselves what values he was bringing to the conversation. And I think that's a very important question, right? What values were being brought into consideration when certain teachings were being rolled out? But, I think there are times when a certain rule makes sense, but other times where it might not. Or, you know, when I kind of challenge the idea of monogamy being super, super important, I also try to be very careful in saying there are clear cases in which non-monogamy is a problem.
Mm, yeah.
Where I am 100% on board with Jacob. But to take an example of the faith tradition I currently practice in, when Community of Christ was expanding to other areas of the world, it ran into cultures where non-monogamous families were present, and they were faced with a sort of challenge here. What do we do with an established family where a man has more than one wife? Traditionally, right, at this time, the RLDS Church was tremendously hostile to the idea of polygamy, and over the course famously so, and yet the RLDS Church came up with a standard for sexual ethics that is actually kind of more permissive than how LDS sexual ethics are right now, which is irony of ironies. Yeah. But there was a recognition that forcing a family from the global south to split up to meet this monogamous standard would actually cause more harm or potentially cause more harm than insisting on than the idea of non-monogamy in the first place. So I think context is very, very important here, and to be deliberate about values that we bring to the conversation, and to recognize that, you know, we can condemn certain forms of non-monogamy, but we can allow this other form of non-monogamy to continue because we think it better fits with our values of not doing harm to families and individuals. That is difficult, right? I tend to be a black and white thinker. I like rules to be straightforward, but when we bring in values and context, that gets a lot messier. But I think a more holistic approach can be more helpful for people along the way.
Wow. Thank you. That's fascascinating to me. Thanks for wandering into Joseph Smith territory with me, even though it's not part of the article. So last question before we wrap up. We're not on a Book of Mormon year, but as people read Jacob, read his temple sermon after reading your essay, what would you hope people would be thinking about as they read that scriptural text? So what's one thing that you would hope they would see in the text that's maybe different from what they've seen before?
If it's okay, I'll make this response a little broader.
Absolutely.
I went into this essay expecting to talk about Jacob 2, Jacob 2, Jacob 2. But I found myself writing about how Jacob more broadly, from the first time he appears in the Book of Mormon, well, maybe the second time, the first time he preaches in the Book of Mormon up until the end of his ministry, he is constantly engaged with what it means to reinterpret scripture for his time. He is often playing with different scriptural texts and trying to make them more relevant for when he is, where he is, and the context that he is preaching and teaching in. That means reinterpreting Isaiah. That means bringing a Christian message into the teachings of the Hebrew Bible when he's facing down with Cherem. That means taking the stories of David and Solomon and saying, God does not like this, even if that never explicitly appears in the Hebrew Bible. And we talked earlier about wanting to have these surface level understandings of scripture. That's appealing. I mentioned I'm a black and white thinker. I like things to be right there on the page. But I think if Jacob teaches me one thing, and if I hope Jacob can teach all of us one thing, it's that we are always in conversation with scripture. What is on the page is not necessarily self-evident. We've got to be in conversation with it. And if Jacob, right, is reinterpreting things to make sense for where he is and when he is, I think that gives us prophetic permission to do the same thing, to take these texts, to treat them seriously, to ascribe holiness to them, but also to stand in conversation with them and ask, what do they mean for us now, even if that means departing a little bit or a lot of bit from how the words appear on the page.
Yeah, well, thank you. I absolutely love that. This has been wonderful to talk to you. Thank you for joining us on Dialogue Out Loud today for this conversation about Spencer Greenhall's article, Jacob's Temple Sermon as Reinterpretation of Scripture and Rethinking of Sexual Ethics. You can read it in the summer 2026 issue of Dialogue, which is up free online now. Or in print with a subscription. Spencer, thank you again for being here today.
Thank you very much. It's been a real pleasure.
And to our listeners, if this episode sparked something for you, we'd love to hear your thoughts. Don't forget to subscribe to Dialogue Out Loud, leave a review, and share this episode with someone who's ready to read the Book of Mormon with fresh eyes. You can read the entire article at dialoguejournal.com. I'm Margaret Olson Hemming. Thank you for joining us.
Greetings. My name is Rebecca DeSchweinitz, and I'm thrilled to serve as a board member at the Dialogue Foundation and as one of the hosts of Dialogue Gospel Study. In each episode, which we record live the second and fourth Sunday of every month, we welcome esteemed speakers from a variety of backgrounds to share their insights and perspectives on the Come Follow Me lessons. Our aim is to spark meaningful conversations about the scriptures, to connect them to our personal experiences and to our understandings and explorations of the gospel. To stay in the loop with our upcoming lessons and this opportunity to engage with Mormon thought, culture, and belief, be sure to visit dialoguejournal.com and sign up for our newsletter. By doing so, you'll receive updates and timely links to join our live stream lessons. Additionally, you can catch up on our past guests and episodes by subscribing to Dialogue Journal on YouTube, Facebook, or wherever you listen to podcasts. Thank you.
Dialogue Podcast Network.